It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Is Italy forgetting to stop and taste the pasta? Is that wonderfully civilized way of balancing the Italian day, the slow and easy lunch, hitting self-destruct?
Italy has had to abandon pausing for long lunch. Italy is now on the world 24-hour clock. If you're in any kind of business that deals with people abroad, you have to keep to those hours. And therefore, you go out for what they call a pausa pranzo, a pause for lunch. Rather than have several courses, you might have one big course, and with that, you might have one glass of wine. A big change in Italy now is wine by the glass.
That was Fred Plotkin. Will Italy become us? Stick around for this, your calls, and more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. How do you feed 9 billion people? That's how many of us will be living on this planet in 40 years, on a planet whose climate is changing much faster than science predicted. So how are we going to pull this off? The venerable National Geographic magazine tackles that question over 8 issues, looking at questions surrounding meat production, aquaculture, the origin of the diet, and the Green Revolution. Well, Dennis Dimmick is executive editor of the magazine. Dennis, thanks for joining us. Good to have you with us.
Hello, Lynn. Nice to talk to you today.
Dennis, I'd like to talk about the article in the May issue by John Foley that talks about how we're going to feed 9 billion people. And he outlines 5 steps. Could you go through them for us?
Sure. Actually, it originated in a research paper that he and a team from the University of Minnesota and other universities assembled and published in the journal Nature in October of 2011. And what we did with John then is to distill that down. And the 5 points are, 1, we need to stop cutting forests and plowing grasslands to improve food productivity. That's how historically we have done it in the past, to raise the amount of food we grow. We just cut forests and plow grasslands. Well, if you want to save forests, if you want to save tigers, if you want to save ecosystems, we need to stop that. Another step is really taking a look at the farms that we already have and see what can we do to improve output yields from all of those farms, especially in places like Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. There's this idea called yield gap, which means the difference between what many farms are doing and what could be done in a particular area. There's a third dimension here, using resources more efficiently. And this is a really fascinating area where agriculture is becoming much more efficient in its use of fertilizers, of water, of energy, to try to do things like reduce nitrate runoff pollution that creates dead zones. But also, as we see more droughts around the world, the idea that we can get more out of the water that we have available so that we can keep growing crops. And I think that this is, it's important to note that this is really not a sort of a big ag versus organic kind of view. It's like everybody has a contribution here, like organic farming can greatly reduce the use of water and chemicals by using things like cover crops, mulches, and compost, all that kind of thing. Actually, it's like everybody has a contribution to make. The fourth of the 5 is to shift diets. This question of how much meat and what kind. When you take a look at what our crops are being grown for, if you look, for example, around the world, 55% of crops are grown to feed people, and 45% or the remainder are grown to feed livestock and for things like energy. And so if you're trying to get more calories to people, the question is how much meat, what kind, beef, chicken, pork, how much of that can we afford to feed when we know that, for example, say a pound of beef might take 10 pounds of grain or a pound of chicken might take 4 pounds of grain. Fish can take slightly over a pound. So in one sense, as an individual, you could decide, well, I'm going to eat less beef and eat more fish, and know that by doing that, you reduce your the amount of land, water, and energy that's being devoted to provide for what you put in your market basket. And the last piece really is about reducing waste. And there's two parts of this. On the front side is on the farm production marketing side. In many underdeveloped countries, in nations that have poor roads, storage, refrigeration, a lot of food could be saved if we had better systems to capture the crop as it's coming off of the field and it's kept refrigerated, or we keep bugs and insects out of the grains. That has a huge impact. That's one kind of food waste that could make more food available for people. But on the other side of that coin is when we look here in the United States, it's about, oh gosh, anywhere from 40 to 50% of the food that we have here available to us in this country is thrown away.
That's stunning. Two figures stand out for me. And one is 45% of what's grown is going to feed animals. That piece, but also, well, for instance, you talked about a field of corn and how it breaks out. The idea of how much of this that's grown doesn't really come into our mouths.
Right. That's an interesting idea to think about when you see vast fields, say, of corn and soybeans. And if you take a look at an acre of corn, for example, in round numbers, say in the U.S., this is not sweet corn. This is field corn that you say when you're traveling across Iowa or Illinois, you see it in large fields. About half of that goes to feed cattle, about a quarter goes now to feed cars, and most of the rest goes to create what's called high fructose corn syrup, which is sugar. That's something to think about, because to think that we're growing this stuff to feed people, actually these feed grade corns are not really specifically designed to feed to people. So if you were going to change the use of the landscape, you're going to have to grow a different kind of crop.
A lot to consider. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Dennis Dimmick is executive editor of National Geographic magazine. The series on How Do We Feed 9 Billion People runs for 8 issues beginning May 2014. It was a cold Thanksgiving weekend in 2008 when the food truck Kogi Barbecue was launched in Los Angeles. Now, behind its wheel was rebel chef Roy Choi, trained in fine dining, but restless to feed the city that he loved with a more democratic approach. His Korean tacos were priced at $2 apiece. In a few months, that truck became the icon of the L.A. street scene. He went on to pick up Food & Wine's Best Chef Award in 2010 and has written a memoir, L.A. Sun, My Life, My City, My Food. Jennifer A. Lee met up with him in his hometown, Los Angeles.
Hey, Roy. Thanks for joining us from L.A.
Good to be here.
I want to say that I love Korean food, and I grew up, you know, Chinese-American in New York City, and my family ate Korean food for Thanksgiving because that was our special meal. And I always couldn't understand why it took so long to break into the mainstream. And so I was wondering, like, why you think you were able to do that, and, you know, whether or not, you know, the mix with Korean tacos was the way that Korean food had to break in. Because your parents ran a Korean restaurant, but at that time it was mostly Korean clientele, correct?
Yeah, correct. And, you know, it's weird because the Kogi taco really never represented Korean food. It represented L.A., but through that gateway somehow it came back to Korea. As far as why Korean food maybe took a while, I think the two parts are, one, maybe Koreans didn't want it to blow up, you know, on the real. You know, we're a hermit culture. We're kind of private in what we do. And we really didn't care whether whether mainstream liked our food or not. You know, most of the menus were written in Korean. None of them were written in English. You know, so it really didn't register in our brains, in our family brains. The other part is, a Korean meal is not a linear meal. It's not like you start at one point and you end at the other. And so the Western way of eating is always appetizer, starter, salad, or whatever, and then main course and then dessert. So you start at A and you end at Z. Korean meal comes from all points at the same time, and it's not on one plate. So I think it was very hard to try to, like, take all of that and put it into a linear form. And then so maybe the streets helped that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and what I always thought was interesting about Korean cuisine was, unlike Chinese food and parts of Japanese food, which really kind of catered to the American palate, Korean food, like, held its ground. And it was, like you said, what it was meant to be. So it's interesting to see how much a phenomenon Korean tacos have become, not just, you know, in L.A. where you started, but across the country. Why do you think it caught fire, like, so quickly?
I mean, the food part is because I believe it was delicious, you know.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, nobody can hate on a taco, you know. So that right there was already a vessel that made people look and care and take a chance. That's one on the food level. On the other level, we combine Twitter with food. So it was the first time kind of food had a voice, a viral voice. And we had a personality behind it. We were out there. We had the same fundamental principles as any chef-driven kitchen, you know, but our attitude and our demeanor and our voice was different. But then when you looked beyond the technology and the voice, you saw organization, cleanliness. You saw hard work ethics and honesty and food. And so I think all of that together created a groundswell for sure. And then the fact that we were mobile, you know, that we could go out to people, and the voice was young. So we hit a whole new generation, made a bridge for people to connect with food.
So, Roy, before you actually started the Korean barbecue truck, your entire background is a mix of highs and lows. Tell me a little bit about all the lines that brought you to Kogi.
It's crazy because the first wave of Korean immigrants, the large wave, there were many that came through Hawaii and some parts of the mainland way before in the early 1900s, but the main wave came in late 60s and early 70s. And that for that first wave, most of them were educated, and but they came, and if you weren't studying science, you ended up, even if you had a PhD in history, nobody was giving you a job. You couldn't get a job. So long story short, we became merchants. And so you had all these educated people ended up owning liquor stores, gas stations, dry cleaners, all that stuff. My parents were the same, came in, opened a liquor store in K-Town, and then our life kind of built from there. You know what I mean? Their whole dream was just to continue to thrive and move up. Many different businesses, from liquor stores to restaurants to jewelry stores, some failed, some succeeded, and all they cared about was their children.
And how do you think that shaped your sort of culinary path?
Oh, shaped everything because, you know, food was always there. They always seemed to find the money or the time to have great food on the table. And then growing up in a restaurant from like third to seventh grade was a big deal. It was crazy because it was like being in, you know, just an environment that's just alive all the time, you know.
And your mom made great kimchi that drew a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, before the restaurant, you know, going back to the immigration, it was about the hustle. You know, any immigrant that comes to this country has their own story of hustle, because in most cases you come here with no money in your pocket. You know what I'm saying? So, like, it don't matter who you were, it matters on who you become. So my mom was cooking all the time, and she was packing kimchis and banchans and dried fish and all these things, and then we'd put them in cardboard boxes, put them in the trunk, and she would just go literally door to door and sell them, you know, like try to find all the Korean families. And then, you know, a reputation built from the, or if there were parties, she would bring all the food. You know, my mom's kind of gangster like that. She doesn't ask permission. You know what I mean? So, like, she'll show up at the party, you know, with a trunk load of food. And, like, she wasn't supposed to show up with a trunk load of food. You know what I mean? That, you got to feel me on that. And so then she'll show up, and the party's going on, and then she'll pull out all this kimchi. And it becomes like an Amway sale, but it's kimchi instead, you know? And, so, yeah, I mean, that definitely built her rep, and then it led to a restaurant.
And how do your parents feel about all your success since then?
I mean, I'm sure they're very proud and happy, and I'm happy and proud for them, but they're still needling me as parents, you know. why don't you do this? Why aren't you in New York? Why aren't you on that? If I'm on Time, why aren't you on CNN? If you're on CNN, why aren't you on this? If you're on public radio, why aren't you on that? You know, So at some point, I had to just be at peace with all that.
Yeah. Hey, Roy, thanks a lot for speaking with us today, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Thank you. It's a new day.
Roy Choi is author of L.A. Sun, My Life, My City, My Food. Jennifer Ait Lee is the publisher of Daily Lit and the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Now, Roy left us with a recipe for beef cheek tacos with salsa verde, as well as a cooler recipe, cardamom milk shave ice. Find them at splendidtable.org. Coming up, how to make your own boozy summer-infused spirits. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The next time you head home from the farmer's market with armfuls of basil and dill and thyme and rosemary, don't head to the fridge. Head to the liquor cabinet. Andrew Schloss loves figuring out how to do it yourself, and his most recent book is Homemade Liqueurs and Infused Spirits, perfect for the summer cocktail season. Our contributor, Noelle Carter, got to work with Andrew.
Andrew, it's so great to talk to you.
Hello. It's a pleasure talking to you, too.
You talk about the rise of home brewing and home winemaking and how that's kind of given rise to homemade liqueurs. And the thing that's so cool about homemade liqueurs is that they're so much easier than homemade beer or wine and that you don't need any special equipment or ingredients.
That's exactly right. The other thing about them is you get really clean flavors because the liquor you're using is already distilled. Since home distillation is not legal in the U.S., you're getting really fresh flavors. So if I take strawberries and I make strawberry wine out of it, it doesn't really taste a lot like strawberry anymore. But if I take those strawberries and infuse them into some vodka with a little bit of sugar, I get this really fresh, authentic strawberry flavor.
And this comes together, you know, within a week, whether or not you've got something that's really good.
Absolutely. You don't have to take months to ferment and to age something, because as soon as the flavors from the fruit or herb or vegetable or whatever you're infusing are into the alcohol, it's done. So it depends on what you're infusing. If I'm doing something really pungent like a black pepper liqueur or a horseradish liqueur, that's going to infuse into the alcohol in about an hour or two. If I'm doing something like fresh strawberries, that might take 5 days. If I'm doing something like dried peaches, that might take 3 days because the peaches are dried, so they're more concentrated.
You know, when I think of homemade liqueurs or when I think of liqueurs in general, I always tended to think of them as something that you would enjoy on a chilly evening, something more winter oriented. But so many of the recipes in your book are seasonal and that they call for, you know, fresh fruits or vegetables. And so it's amazing how many of these liqueurs are perfect for summer.
Absolutely. The thing about old-style liqueurs is liqueurs started as medicinals, and they were frequently recipes that had 60, 80 ingredients in them, very complex combinations of flavors, and they were highly sugared to make them sort of syrupy. And I think that's why we associate them with cooler weathers or heartier kind of things. But the fact is that when I'm tincturing anything into alcohol, I can get a really fresh flavor, and I can also control the sugar. I don't need a lot of sugar to make the flavors of the fruit or the herb or the vegetable come out. Alcohol has this amazing ability to bond onto other molecules. So if I'm cooking with, let's say, I don't know, garlic, and I sauté it, I'm going to get this pungent garlic flavor because that flavor is an aroma. And aromas are only perceived through oil in the nose. If I boil that garlic, I'm going to get more sweetness because the sugar in it is going to come out, and I don't have an oil that will carry the garlic flavor into my system, so I don't perceive it. If I put that garlic into alcohol, both the sugar and the garlicky aromas get attached to the alcohol, so I get this full-bodied flavor all at once.
Wow. You have a couple of cocktails that seem perfect for the season. I recently tried your grapefruit tonic, and it was amazing.
Grapefruit's one of my favorite citruses. And one of the things I like in citrus fruit is the flavor of the peel. The peel contains bitter alkaloids that are healthy for you. And I'm a big fan of bitterness when it is counteracted with all the other mouth flavors, with sour and sweet and salty. So I work with bitterness a lot. I think it's sort of an interesting thing. And grapefruit is one of the only citruses that still retains some bitterness in its peel. So when you put grapefruit peel into vodka or any kind of alcohol, you're going to get a little bit of bitterness to it. And tonics are also a bitter, healthful beverage. And they are made from cinchona bark, which has a lot of these alkaloids in it. So I combine the bitterness of the grapefruit, the bitterness of the cinchona, and put it into vodka, and then just let it sit for about a week. You get this really tangy, fruity, bitter, sweet thing. Oh, with sweet, I forgot the sugar. You put some sugar in there, too, to get some sweetness. And you get this liqueur that all you have to do is add a spark of seltzer to it, and you get the citrusy gin and tonic when you're done.
It just sounds amazing. You also have a bunch of, I'm a big strawberry fan, and you have a few really, really tempting strawberry liqueur recipes. Do you have a favorite?
The one that I like the best are the straightforward ones. So there's one called In Praise of Phrase, which is just some strawberries, simple syrup, and vodka. And they're just put together. They sit together for about a week. You strain it out, and you get this elixir, this liquid that is the pure essence of strawberries. So if you have like ripe strawberries right now, you put them mm-hmm. into vodka, all of that ripe flavor goes into the alcohol and stays there. So a year later, it's still there as if you just picked that strawberry.
And these recipes, so many of them are so simple. They only call for a few ingredients. You can make a run to your regular grocery store and you've got the makings of a great gift or a great cocktail idea for summer entertaining.
Yeah, they're beautiful too. Like the strawberry one we were just talking about is this gorgeous ruby color, because the color also gets trapped by the alcohol. So it's like no work, and you have this amazing tasting and looking thing.
So I'm curious, when you think homemade liqueurs or infusing alcohols, I've always thought of using a neutral spirit, you know, something like, say, a vodka. But so many of the recipes that you use call for richer liquors like brandies, or you even use wines in some of the recipes.
You want the neutral spirit when you don't want to have any other flavors there other than the solid ingredient that you're infusing into the liqueur. But when I make apple liqueurs, I frequently use a cognac or a bourbon, because the caramely flavors in those brown liquors work very well with apple and pear and cinnamon flavors. Like if I'm doing herbal or spicy liqueurs, starting with a brown liqueur gives you sort of that head start. And you also have that vanilla flavor from the aging in wood. Tequilas are amazing with vegetable flavors. So I do a lot of bell pepper and chili pepper and fennel and that kind of thing with tequila. Rum is wonderful with tropical fruits like mango and pineapple and those kind of flavors.
Well, Andrew, I really want to thank you so much. This was so much fun and fascinating.
It was a pleasure.
Andrew Schloss is the author of Homemade Liqueurs and Infused Spirits. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, Andrew left us with a couple of recipes to get you started. Praise of Phrase, that's a strawberry liqueur, blueberry cinnamon, and a vegetable take, sweet pepper surprise. And you know where they are, splendidtable.org. I have a theory. The world's favorite foreign food is Italian. We love those tastes. We go to Italy primed for great eating. It's part and parcel of the culture. The art and architecture aren't so bad either. Now, few people bring together an understanding of Italy's foods, its mentalities, and its culture. Fred Plotkin does this in his classic guide, Italy for the Gourmet Traveler, which has just been updated. Fred, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn. You're so kind.
You know, you do something in your book I have not seen in other books, and I love it. It's called Classic Towns. And it's these classic towns are not the ones you would expect. It's not Rome and Florence and that kind of thing. Why don't you explain what a classic town is?
Well, actually, Rome is one of them, but you're right in the point you're making. I identified for each of the 21 regions I describe a town that gathers within its walls much of what is typical about that region. So rather than have you go to, let's say, Bologna, well, Bologna is a classic town too, rather than have you go to Genoa or Portofino or the Cinque Terre in Liguria, I send you to San Remo because San Remo is really much more typically Ligurian, whatever that means. And therefore, a visitor who wants to discover a region and uses my book will find what makes these regions typical, food-wise, culturally, scenically, in terms of the temperament of the people. And when we travel nowadays, we don't have extra time. So therefore, I want you to get right to the essence of a place.
What I like about this idea is the places you've generally chosen are places that let you really drop into Italian life.
Yeah, because people want, for me at least, the real Italy. They don't want touristic prepackaged Italy.
So can you give us an example of one or two?
Well, let's go to Sicily right away. Syracuse, is one of the great towns of Italy, period. And because it's tucked in the lower right-hand corner of the island, this triangle-shaped island, a lot of people don't get there. They get as far as Taormina, which is very beautiful, but has been a tourist resort since Roman times. And rather, I have them go further to a place that has incredible Greek ruins and temples. It has fabulous food, the best tuna, the best swordfish, a wonderful market, a wonderful passeggiata, the stroll in the afternoon. And it's close to some of the best ice cream you'll ever taste.
And as I remember, the light is like nothing you've ever seen. I mean, it's true. The town glows.
Well, it glows in part because the marble that they use to build the town is a sort of ochre-colored marble. So when the sunlight hits it in the afternoon, that's why everything glows.
Quite amazing. And this is Sicily, and this would be the east coast of Sicily.
Yes.
Where would we eat in Syracuse? I know. You have to pick one of your – who's your favorite kid? Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a little spit of land called Ortigia. And Ortigia is the original ancient community. And there are several restaurants there facing the harbor. One of them is called Archimede, like Archimedes, who is from there. Trattoria Archimede, you eat very well. But there are about 10 places in my book on Ortigia that you eat equally well.
And what the kinds of things that you do eat there?
Swordfish, tuna, pasta, eggplant, mussels, fabulous fruit, almond granita, coffee, beautiful breads, everything with olive oil, pasta with breadcrumbs, sardines, heaven.
Oh, boy.
And healthy.
All right. Where else? Another classic town.
Well, in the region of the Marche, which is in the center of the country, I call it Eastern Tuscany. It's actually the Tuscany less touristed. And it has a coastline on the Adriatic, wonderful fish, 76 gorgeous historic opera houses in one little region. For people who love shoes, a lot of the fanciest Italian shoes are made there. There's Urbino, which I call the classic town. It's where Raphael was from. Nearby are cheese caves where Michelangelo stored his pecorino cheese. And so that's the classic town, and Urbino is wonderful. But I would also send you to the town of Macerata. Macerata is now the place when people who have never been to Italy call me up and say, Fred, we want to go to a place where we will discover as much as we can of Italy in one town. I send them there. It's a medieval town. It has a university. It's a hill town. It's surrounded by gorgeous green nature, rolling hills. The lamb from the nearby town of Viso is amazing. The pork products are amazing. They have a lasagna only there called Vinces Grassi, which does not mean victory of the fat, but it was named for an Austrian general who occupied the place in 1796, whose name was Windischgratz. And Windischgratz became Vinces Grassi. It's heaven. They have a fantastic summer opera festival in the Sferi Stadio, which is an outdoor handball arena that has perfect acoustics. Everything you'd want from Italy in one town.
How big a town is this?
There are about 30,000 people, and you can easily negotiate up and down the hills. It also has a beautiful city hall, a gorgeous Duomo, a university, an art museum, everything you want. It's Italy in one little place.
You know what's coming next. Where should we go to eat the vinci scrasse?
There are a couple of places I like there. One of them is called San Secondo, and that's where people typically go for vinci scrasse. But my favorite little place, which will now be bombarded with all of your listeners, Lynn, is Trattoria Rosa, like the rose. And they also do something else there, scrambled eggs with truffles, not just for breakfast, but any time of the day. And it, too, is just a phenomenal dish. The wines are very local, just a white and a red. But these two places, what's interesting about it is that the hotel scene is just, there's just one hotel, the Claudiani. It's not been really developed for tourism, and that's part of its charm. It's very local. The Rosa has a few rooms. There are rooms outside of town. But really, it's unspoiled.
Sounds like heaven. It really does.
It is.
Fred, you're in and out of Italy constantly. What changes are you seeing?
I just came back last week from a visit to Turin and Milan. The main thing, certainly in big cities like Turin and Milan, but all over the country, is that Italy has not given up, but it's had to abandon some of its traditions in terms of pausing for long lunch, in terms of meals that have multi-courses. This is due in part to the economy, but it's due more to the fact that Italy is now on the world 24-hour clock. And if you wake up and you have clients in China and Japan, and you have to deal with them, then you have European clients and you have North American clients. If you're in any kind of business that deals with people abroad, you have to keep to those hours. Banks, office workers in big cities often remain open all the time. And therefore, you go out for what they call a pausa pranzo, a pause for lunch. It used to be you went out for lunch. So now at lunch, rather than have several courses, you might have one big course, such as in Milan or Turin, a risotto. And it'll be a delicious risotto, and it will be a bigger portion than you got in the past. And that would be your monopasto, your singular meal. And with that, you might have one glass of wine. A big change in Italy now is wine by the glass. And the wine is fabulous, actually. It's better than ever. And that's another point, that if you're going to drink less, you want to drink really well.
Fred, thank you so much.
Ciao, Lynn.
Fred Plotkin is author of the newly revised Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Fred lays claim to the pesto recipe to end all pesto recipes. Don't even question this. Find his Pesto alla Genovese on the website splendidtable.org. We'll be back in a minute with your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to connect with you. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, you can send us an email. You just go to splendidtable.org. Petra's on the line from Sacramento. Petra, what fascinating thing do you want to talk about?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
So excited. So my girlfriend made candied oranges, and she has about a little bit less than a quart of orange-flavored simple syrup. And neither of us are big drinkers, and we also are – how challenging do you want this? She's a vegetarian. I eat meat, but I can't do dairy, cream. I can do eggs, and I can't do gluten.
All right. Okay. This is not a problem. This is not a problem. Because, first of all, what you can do with that syrup – let's just start with the syrup on its own, okay? Mm-hmm. That syrup can be spiced up. So you can take that syrup, warm it up on the stove. Now, you could add chili to it, believe it or not.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
It could be fabulous with chili. The other place, I am using now a combination almost constantly of black pepper, cinnamon sticks, whole allspice, and a little clove that I grind in my coffee grinder.
And it's going into soups and stews and things with a lot of other seasonings. And it's delicious. But you could just put those whole things, some whole black peppercorns, one or two cracked cinnamon sticks, some lightly bruised allspice in there with the chili if you wanted or on their own. And you would have an ambrosia-like. Now, the other thing that's really wonderful is put those all aside. Take this syrup, okay, with the orange.
Okay.
And split a vanilla bean or two and warm that in there and let it sit and then strain it out. And then so you can, you know, you can make these like tea. Obviously, you warm up. You then let these seasonings sit in the syrup and then you strain the syrup. Now that you've done all that, you just toss summer melons, peaches, the fresh strawberries in this combination. And it could be fabulous, really wonderful. Not to mention what happens if you take that syrup, especially with the chili, and you could throw some garlic into it, and you brush that on sweet potatoes that you roast on the grill. You cut rounds that are about a half inch thick, and you slow roast them. And toward the end of roasting, you start brushing them. They're going to be like eating candy.
Oh, man.
They're so good. And obviously, you can use that on meats and that kind of thing. But I think it could be great fun to do things. You know, I know this is really bonkers, but I wonder what the spiced one with the chili and all the spices in it, you know, the cinnamon or whatever, would taste like brushed on corn on the cob with some, well, you can't eat dairy. I was going to say with some butter.
Oh, I can have fake butter. There's good fake butter.
Okay. All right. All right. So with fake butter, I just think that could be really sexy.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
But I mean, think of all the vegetables, green beans. You could add vinegar to the mixture as you toss it with green beans. You have sweet sour sauce and sweet sour sauce. I mean, that could end up in a stir fry. It could end up with, you know, any kind of seafood that you like. And with your friend being a vegetarian, I mean, my gosh, tofu rolled in that with a bit of lemon or vinegar.
Oh, you know, so
you
get,
and then you grill it.
Yeah.
I mean, well, just let your imagination fly. Because, I mean, what you've got basically there is a dessert / savory collection of possibilities.
Wow, I never would have thought of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, you puree some onion into that.
Oh,
I mean, that could be, or just chunk up onion, because I think pureeing would cloud it and make it yucky looking. It sounds like it's so beautiful. Chunk up some red onion in that, and then you just spoon it over whatever you want.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, it's. I don't know, I have this thing, I can never leave well enough alone. That's where all that comes from. You know,
like, well, we have almost a quart, and she'll make it probably.
I think you're going to need far more than a quart. She has to start doing candied oranges again.
Yeah, she has to make me some.
Petra, I hope you enjoy it, and you just have a blast.
Thank you so much for your help.
You are welcome. Take care.
You too.
Bye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can call us. Cheryl's on the line from California. Cheryl, do you have something you want to talk about?
Yes. Hi, Lynn. It's so great to talk to you.
Well, good to talk to you, too.
I have a problem with cornbread. I love cornbread. It's a big tradition in all of my family, but I just don't like the texture. You know, all the recipes say to use medium grind, and that's pretty much all I've ever found in the store. I looked for fine grind. But do you have a suggestion? I've tried whirring it in the food processor, and that didn't seem to work.
Huh. That's very interesting. Have you gone online looking for fine grind?
No, I haven't done that. We have, you know, a lot of options here. I thought maybe I could find it at Whole Foods or something, but I just I found corn flour, but I was kind of thinking that would be going too far the other direction.
Well, you could mix the two.
Uh-huh.
A half and half.
Now, I've tried doing that, and I still get that gritty texture.
Then get rid of the coarse cornmeal and just go with the corn flour. But there's one thing: remember that when you do that, do you have a kitchen scale by any chance, or just a scale of any kind? Okay.
Yes, I do.
Weigh your cornmeal that you normally use. You know, however you normally measure it. Weigh it, because a cup of corn flour is going to weigh more and give you more corn flour than a cup of cornmeal, because the corn flour is more finely ground.
Oh,
So okay. more of it can go into that measurement. So do it by weight.
Okay. And then one other thought. I do have a Vitamix blender. Could I put the cornmeal in there and try to grind it more finely?
Try it.
Would
sure.
that work better?
Absolutely. Put a half a cup in or whatever and see what happens. Because a Vitamix can pulverize almost anything, including maybe cinder blocks. I mean, a Vitamix is really a powerful machine. See what it does for you. But okay. don't let the cornmeal get hot. Because, okay. you know, as you grind it, the friction, because that can really eliminate some of the nutrients. And you don't want to do that.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Okay, great.
But I think you're going to have great luck. The Vitamix should
All
solve
right.
your problem. Okay.
Thank you.
You are welcome. Bye.
Have a great day.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Okay, we've got Anna calling from Minneapolis. Anna, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for taking my question.
You are more than welcome.
Lovely. So I have this really fabulous pound cake recipe. And so what I've been doing is, you know, adding some other extract like almonds or adding some citrus zest, and it always comes out great. And I, what I really want to do now is do like chocolate pound cake or like espresso pound cake, but I'm too afraid of
throwing the balance off.
The yeah. recipe, yeah, because yeah. I want to do like cocoa, but then I'd be throwing a ton of cocoa powder in with the flour, and then it's going to throw off everything. And so I was wondering
well,
if you
with
had
the
any.
Cocoa, the cocoa, the thing you have there is you have an acid. Same thing with the, with adding espresso. But let me ask you something. Mm-hmm. How do you mix this recipe? How do you put those ingredients together?
Creaming the butter and the sugar for like 5 minutes on high. So it gets really fluffy. And then
right.
adding the eggs one at a time until all the eggs appear. And then once that all is together, once the eggs and the butter and the sugar are together, it almost looks like the batter's kind of curdled.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we add in, it's cake flour. And then I add in, vanilla and salt go in right before the flour. And then I add in the flour kind of slowly. Bowl, stuff like that. So.
You know, this is my instinct about this. First of all, I think you could add cocoa without a problem.
Really?
I okay. think you would be okay with the cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
It is acidic. It may throw mm-hmm. off some of the chemistry, but I'm not sure that it will.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I would love to see, I mean, you've done the citrus stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would love to have a coffee-flavored pound cake. And I wonder if you couldn't do this. If you melt some instant or just make very, very strong espresso.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And just use, and I mean really make a concentrate. You mm-hmm. use a lot of grounds and you then do the boiling water or the hot water
yeah.
and let it
mm-hmm.
sit so that you get mm-hmm. a real concentrate and add maybe a quarter of a cup or a half,
really?
Yeah, or a third of a cup. Of that,
okay.
now you're going to strain it. You're not going to have the grounds in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you're going to strain it. But I would say a quarter to a third of a cup and see what
okay.
happens.
Yeah, and that, yeah, that would be, that you're giving me so much confidence because I'm always like, oh, I don't want to like putting in a little lemon juice, for example. Yeah. Of course, it turns out fine, but it's like anything that's like quite going to throw off the consistency.
Well,
kind
you
of
know,
terrifies me.
Your instincts are very good, though, because with cakes, you know, if you were making a soup, you can play
yeah,
with it.
Good.
With cakes,
yeah.
cakes are really about chemistry and about mm-hmm. mathematics, and they're very careful mm-hmm. balances. But a pound cake is really forgiving. And the worst thing that happens is this pound cake does not turn out the way all the others do.
Yeah, and there you go.
There are some really good books out there on food science. Shirley Currier is one mm-hmm. of them. Harold McGee. And then there is, it's a textbook, but there's a book called Simply Practical Baking. It's for the trade. But if you
get some,
and you know who else talks cake science brilliantly, maybe better than everybody, is Rose Levy Barenboim. And a long time ago, she did a book called The Cake Bible. Now, don't change your pound cake recipe, but get a hold of the Cake Bible to see what she says about flavoring, about adding acid, because she's got pound cakes in there.
Oh, lovely.
But I think a pound cake is really forgiving, and I think if you do, you know, start out with relative small amounts, and then you can just keep building and building.
Oh,
That sounds fabulous. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And boy, do you make my mouth water.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks, great. Anna.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye.
Okay. You can reach us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Or you can actually use a phone, 800-537-5252. Grady is calling from Mockville, North Carolina. Grady, what is on your mind?
In my yard and in my garden, there are these wild green onions. At least I've always called them onions because That's what my father calls them, but
right.
They're more like garlic in flavor. I've used them in chimichurris instead of garlic. I've used them in a jicama slaw, but the flavor is just so strong that I don't really know how to temper it. I've used more vinegar, but that tends to overpower it. I've used more lime juice or lemon juice, and that just changes the flavor of the entire thing. I was hoping you could lend some advice.
So you're using the roots. You're not using the spears.
I haven't tried using the spears. I guess I could do that like a chive, couldn't I?
Yeah, you could. Yeah, because they'll have a milder taste. And you can use them raw, obviously. But I see what you've got. That stuff is powerful. You know, there are a lot of different kinds of garlic. And some of them are so fierce and hot and aggressive that, you know, you actually stand back when you get a piece of it in your mouth. It's just kind of startling. And I think what you want to do is, first of all, try an experiment with this. With the garlic root, crush a small amount of it and take about a cup of cream and simmer it in the cream. Okay.
It sounds fantastic so far.
Right. I mean, first of all, obviously it's going to be fatty, but when you get very strong flavors from the onion family, often milk products, and especially ones that are high in fat, will be the thing that essentially neutralizes them. Not always the case, but see what happens. And there's a couple of other things you can do with it, too. Cook those whole cloves or the whole head if it's really young.
All right.
Cook it whole. Put them in a little olive oil with water in a pan and you cover that. And you just keep adding a bit of water as you need it with some salt and pepper maybe. And you let that, you don't want to crush them. You just let that cook until you can easily put a knife through it. And I would do it in a saucepan. And if you want to, then you can boil off whatever water there is. Don't burn them. Don't let them brown at all. And taste it, because first of all, it may be utterly delicious. It may be like a fabulous, flavorful butter. And you may, it'll be a new world. And you could also do it in the cream. And then at that point.
Oh, that'd be great. Do like a pollo con crema?
Yes.
Right?
You're singing my song. Oh, gosh, yes, that would be wonderful. And maybe a little bit of Spanish paprika in there, you know?
I've got fantastic smoked paprika that I got from a friend who visited New Orleans. I might have to use that.
That would be wonderful. Cook it in toward the end. Be careful. It can be very spicy. Just taste it. You know, you decide. But use the spears where you want the more gentle flavor.
All right. What about roasting it with?
Oh, yeah, same deal. Same deal. Just don't let it get super brown because it gets bitter. But, yes, you could absolutely roast it. In fact, what you could do is you could just put those pieces in foil, add a little moisture to the packet, and put them in a 300-degree oven and forget about them for an hour or two until you can easily pierce them with a knife. And then you can
That sounds fantastic.
I think you're on to something, and I think you've also got a very special garlic there.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, I'm one of the people who's paid up to $8 for one of those bulbs so I could plant, you know, a special kind of garlic that isn't generally available. You may want to think of going into business as well.
Well, we'll come to Mockville. I'll give you as much as I have.
I would love it. I would love it. Grady, thank you. And I'm jealous.
Thank you so much, man.
You are welcome. Bye. By the way, one of the things that never gives up, And trust me, if it grows in my garden, it's a real trooper, is garlic chives. And they have a flat spear on them. And they will keep growing and returning every year, no matter what you do to them. And one of the loveliest things is that as the summer progresses, they get heads of white flowers. And what they really are clusters of perhaps 100 tiny star-shaped white flowers with pale yellow dots in the center. And you just scatter that over a salad or over almost anything, you know, a big plate of cut-up chicken or something with some of the chives, some of the stem. It is just fabulous. It looks like nothing on earth. And they have this faint garlic flavor. But there's a kind of green metallic almost garlickiness to the flat leaves. So if you want to experiment, plant a few of them. You'll have them forever. You can pass them on to grandchildren or whatever. Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this ancient saying that has always been far more political than culinary. A fish rots from the head down. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, at this point, I'm quite certain that the keys to a happy life can be found at splendidtable.org. Find information on anything you heard here today. You can browse through our recipes, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Take a look at our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. You get the idea. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.